Our cup of tea. Yeah, okay, maybe a cup of tea, put it in the computer so that will boost up its energy. Because it's not like sometimes you wake up in the morning and have a cup of tea and you're fine. So maybe that computer needs a cup of tea. But it was playing around on the weekend. So I'm not sure what's happening. But anyway, it doesn't really matter because we're all about letting go of wanting. So all those people overseas, they don't want to listen to it. Just want to see it's good enough for now. Every time you want, it's suffering. You know, the proof of the pudding. Anything happening yet? Couldn't be still checking. So I'll just carry on. Okay, I have to carry on. Those overseas can get it on. Anyway, I don't know why people want to live overseas. There's a couple of things. Anyway, so now we have on this fading away of wanting, the ending of suffering, we have the dependent cessation of all phenomena. This is the same as that concept we have in Buddhism of dependent origination. Well, we always call it dependent origination, that things starting and building up. But the other half of it is called dependent cessation. And it's just almost like psychologically, why is it that people always say, oh, dependent origination. Very few people actually give this reverse any sort of any emphasis. So by calling it dependent cessation, then it shows that there's something else going on here. And this is the cessation of wanting, the cessation of this whole process of existence. Remember, the wanting which causes the suffering is not just wanting for pleasures and wanting to play around in the world of the five senses, it's also wanting to be. So how can you cease to be? So anyway, here we go. With the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting comes a cessation of fuel, the upadana. Sometimes people translate this as craving or attachment, but that's not really what it means. Upadana is the fuel which something takes up. And the best example of that was the story of like the flame and the candle. And a flame of a candle takes up three things. It takes the wax, it takes up some of the wick, and it takes up the heat of the last act of combustion, creating the new flame. So that's its fuel. It's not just, the fuel is not just the wax, it's not just the wick, it's the heat from the past. Keeps that flame going. And when one of those causes is removed, then the flame ceases without remainder. It's gone. And the reason I mention this is because the Buddha was asked this person, well, where does it go? Does it go to that? Do flames, if there have been good flames, go to heaven? Where all lovely flames can live happily ever after. And all bad flames, they'll go to some hell realm of flames. This is not stopped now. Hello? Hello? Okay, it's going to get started again now. So, of course, none of those apply. That's that stupid use of language. The flame is caused by three things. When any one of those things stop, so does the flame. And one of the reasons I mention that old story is from the Agni-Vajra-Gotra Sutta is because that is precisely how Patachara became an arahat. She was in her kuti just watching a flame and the wind blew the flame out and another enlightened woman appeared in the world. That was Patachara's story. Of course, you've seen many flames go out, but she had all the training, all of the suffering she understood, and that was just the last thing, the last little thing she needed for her to see. Just the essential,
essential nothingness of her existence. Anyway, here we go. So with the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting comes the cessation of fuel. This is the psychic fuel which keeps you going. Cessation of that fuel, cessation of states of existence, bawa. And you can't really call bawa just becoming, as some people, quite, that's a really bad translation. Linguistically, logically, because they have the different states of existence, like manusabhava, the state of existence of being a human being, the state of existence of being an animal, states of existence of being a deva. These are all different states of existence. And with the cessation of states of existence, when there's no state of existence to go to, there's no rebirth. With the cessation of rebirth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, unhappiness and distress cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This is a passing away of suffering. So you can imagine just this thing which you take to be you, your personal identity, this process which keeps flowing from moment to moment, day after day, keeping on going. Sometimes that. What keeps that process going? It's wanting. But not just one type of wanting, there's many types of wanting. And when that wanting fades away and ceases, then the whole fuel is like you run out of gas. Your petrol is all gone, and there's no hydrogen, no electricity, there's nothing left to keep you running. So eventually you just stop, run out of fuel. The cessation, subsiding and passing away of form, that includes body, your body, of experience, vedana, of perception, of will and of consciousnesses. And I'm going to pause because this is powerful teachings. Cessation, subsiding and passing away of your consciousnesses. Remember, those of you who remember me teaching before, it's not just one consciousness. It's sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, knowing. And each one of those is separate, has separate identities, if you like. When there's one there, the other one's gone. In meditation, you can see this really quite clearly. It's one of the great insights which come to distinguish the different types of consciousness. And each one of these fades away, stops, and never comes up again. And you will, choice, which I often focus on that because that is a powerful recognition of who chose to do what. That thing you take to be yours, my will, that too passes away. The cessation subsiding and passing away, these what they call the five components of existence, is the cessation of suffering. The subsiding of affliction, the passing away of aging and death. This is not Ajahn Brahm saying this, this is just translating the Buddha with accurate translations. This is peaceful. This is sublime. That is the stilling, samatha. That's the word in the text. Of all will, sankhara. The relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of wanting, fading away, cessation, nibbana. That's peaceful, that's sublime. That whole idea of the stilling of your will, otherwise known as letting things be. Giving up, not doing things, not choosing, not making any preferences. Not judging. What's that got to do with will? You judge first and then you will afterwards. The ceasing of all these things, that is peaceful, that is sublime. That is nibbana. When excited by wanting, overcome by wanting, because wanting is exciting. When full of aversion, overcome by aversion, No, aversion is fun. Getting angry at somebody, finding an enemy, it's I don't know, Mr. Trump's fault, it's the coronavirus's fault, this is just nature, the nature of things to be like this. When deluded, overcome by delusion. We have the old saying in English, ignorance is bliss. Is it? For a little while, I still can't go past, because sometimes I'm a bit too serious and I've got to lighten up for these talks. Sometimes I still remember one of my favourite Calvin and Hobbes cartoons, where the teacher is going through the American Constitution and starts off by, everyone has the right to the pursuit of happiness. And Calvin says, well, if ignorance is bliss and I have a constitutional right to the pursuit of happiness, I'm leaving school. There's a certain logic in that argument. Anyway, when excited by wanting, full of aversion, deluded by deluded, overcome by delusion, when the mind is obsessed by these are called the three poisons in all types of Buddhism. This is sometimes called greed, hatred, and delusion. But that gets, greed is just too intense. It's even small types of wanting. Hatred, even small types of aversion. And greed, hatred, delusion, yet delusion is good. That's a good translation. With the mind obsessed by these, you intentionally create problems for yourself, for others, or for both. How many problems have you experienced last week? Where do they come from? Were they your fault? Yes, they were. You got born, so you're going to have some problems. You intentionally create problems for yourself, for others, or for both. And you experience mental suffering and depression, but when wanting, aversion, and delusion are abandoned, you do not intentionally create any problems for yourself, for others, or for both. And you do not experience mental suffering and depression. It is in this way Nirvana can be experienced directly. In other words, you get a taste of what Nirvana is like. No greed, no wanting, no aversion. You get a pain, well, it's part of having a body, you'll have pain. You won't get what you want, well, that's for life. You can't hear the talk, well, that's life. Sometimes things go wrong. Computers are suffering. It is in this way Nirvana can be experienced directly. The destruction of wanting, the destruction of aversion, the destruction of delusion, that is called Nirvana with residue remaining. What does it mean by residue remaining? Okay, well, just describe that because it's so well known, it's not controversial at all. Nirvana with residue remaining is when a person understands the Dhamma, they realize the Dhamma, they overcome all their wanting, no greed, no hatred, no delusion, none of the poisons, which means they are an arahat, just like the Buddha became an arahat. When the Buddha became an arahat, did he disappear? Did he go poof out of existence? No, he taught for 45 years. I mentioned that in Indonesia where I just came back from. 45 years the Buddha was a monk, and then he passed away. And then I remembered, how long has Ajahn Brahm been a monk? 45 years. Oh, it's a very dangerous year for a monk, the 45th year. Anyway, so it's a person fully enlightened. They don't have any more work to be done. They've attained the goal, but their five components of existence are still going on. And when they pass away, when they stop breathing and the brain stops and their five components of existence fall apart, especially the first one, when they die, then nothing gets reborn. And that's the enlightenment with nothing remaining. So, an enlightened being, an arahat, still with a body, that's the, with remainder, when their body is totally gone, that's the remainder less. So, the Arahant. Is this okay on the board? Give out good. If one is intent on the end of wanting and clarity of mind, when one sees the arising of any of the six senses, with the mind, if one is intent on the end of wanting and clarity of mind, when one sees the arising of any of the six senses, one's mind is completely free from wanting. For one of peaceful mind, one completely liberated, there's nothing further to be done. No need to increase what has been done. Have you ever experienced that in meditation? You just, whatever you're experiencing, just, you don't want anything. And you really don't want anything. You're just sitting there, being peaceful with what's happening. Don't want to get rid of, don't want to develop. You just let go of wanting. Such a peaceful, beautiful state, and it just develops into incredible deep meditations. You get completely free from wanting, and you get incredible clarity. That's one thing which I have a hard time explaining. People say, well, if you don't want anything, you just fall asleep and get down in some unconscious state. No way. You get fully aware. As a stone mountain, one solid mass is not stirred by the wind. So no sights, sounds, odors, tastes, touches or mind objects, desirable or undesirable, stir the stability of the mind. The mind is steady and freed, and you witness the vanishing of the mind. I love that quote. Because when it's steady and freed, when nothing moves, that's when things disappear. That's the old story of meditating in a Zen monastery as a young man in north of England, and I didn't know what we were supposed to do, which was great. You had few instructions, and I just had to keep your eyes open watching this whitewashed wall. It's in an old barn, sitting there just watching a wall for hours, and after about 40 minutes or something, the eyes open, the wall vanished. It disappeared. It wasn't there anymore. That was so cool. It's like weird. I never expected that. I never saw that coming. Once there was a wall there and it all vanished. And after a while, it's quite obvious, your brain only notices things which change. If you are still, I mean really still, and you watch the wall, then after a little while, the wall vanishes, it disappears. The sense of sight turns off. Because this is what happens when the mind is steady and freed. You witness the vanishing of the mind. Cool. And one who has considered all the contrasts of this earth, when things change, when you're aware of contrast, this and that, of course there's movement and things don't stop. One who has considered all the contrasts of this earth and is no more disturbed by anything whatever in the world, the peaceful one, freed from rage, from frustration, from wanting, the stream of consciousness will not be reborn. This is another of my favorite bhikkhunis, Wajira. And this is one of the greatest descriptions of what it actually feels like if you're enlightened. What does it feel like? How do you experience life if you're an enlightened being? So Mara asks, by whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has this being arisen? And where does this being cease? He asked this of a meditating nun. He didn't realize he was asking a fully enlightened arahat. The bhikkhuni arahat Wajira replies, why now do you assume a being, Mara? Is that your wrong view? This is just a heap of sankharas. Here no being is found. Just as with the coming together of parts, the word vehicle is used. So when the five components of exist, existence exist. There is a conventional term, a being. It is only dukkha, suffering, that comes to be. Dukkha that stands, and dukkha that falls away. Nothing but dukkha comes to be. Nothing but dukkha ceases. Weird. I thought when you're enlightened, you're supposed to be happy. But she said all she experiences is dukkha. Ho ho ho, hum hum. What's the solution to that? It's obviously that's the little bit of suffering which is left. And she knows that the work has been completed. This is again another simile from the Theragata. The verses of the enlightened monks, I think it's most enlightened monks, enlightened nuns sometimes say the same thing. But it's the like a workman waiting for his wages. An enlightened being. So you've done the work. You're just waiting for the check to arrive in the mail. And when it does, that's it. Parinibbana. Finished. So, that's what Jiva, she's just waiting for the paycheck. That's the suffering she has left. And everything else, gone. An arahat understands that these six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind, will cease completely and totally with remainder, and no other senses will arise anywhere in any way. This is another way one knows that there is nothing more to be done, an arahat. That is, I remember just asking Ajahn Brahmali in all his searchings through the suttas, where is it the most clear that after a person becomes a nirvana without remainder, once the arahat passes away, that there's no conscious experience at all afterwards, that there's no more senses? And he said, he quoted this one, so I put this one in the book. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, from the Salayatana Samyutta, these six senses. An arahat, fully attained being, understands that the six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind as well, the mind, will cease completely and totally without remainder, and no other senses will arise anywhere, in any way. This is another way one knows that there's nothing more to be done, the arahat. Any questions on that? That's pretty heavy stuff, but it's how the Buddha taught. And I'm not watering it down for you. I'll just explain it as it is. Okay, any questions? Sorry? Yeah, this is Wajira, still alive. She was just meditating and Mara tried to catch her out. No. Who created this being? Who are you? And she said, no, there is no being there. All there is, and the way she put it was so beautifully, all there is suffering arising, suffering being, and suffering passing away. So that's all there is, nothing else. The way she said it with such authority and such simplicity. And sometimes we always try and find a way to find a way out, way of speaking where she, well, that's not what she really meant or something. But no, that's totally Buddhist, totally clear and powerful. So it's a very good, I often quote that myself when I'm teaching. Thank you for asking a question. Wonderful. Okay, so we go on to the fourth part. The noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Is that okay? Okay, can you hear okay? No one's actually saying anything. Please put your hand up if you can hear okay. Okay, very good. Sometimes being a speaker, someone say, "Can you hear?" And sometimes no one says anything because they can't hear the question. So just checking. So the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. There are these two extremes which should be avoided. Actually, I'll pause a little bit there because sometimes I ask people, what is the first teaching the Buddha gave after he became enlightened? And some people say the Four Noble Truths. And I say, no, this about the middle way. That was before the Four Noble Truths, only about a minute or two. But I mentioned that was the first teaching the Buddha gave about the middle way, just to emphasize its importance. There are these two extremes that should be avoided. The pursuit of happiness through the five senses, not the sixth sense again, pursuit of happiness through the sixth sense actually leads to nirvana. There are these two extremes that should be avoided. The pursuit of happiness through the five senses, which is low. And the word for low there is called hina. And so, where have you heard that hina word before? Exactly, yeah, that's where it comes from. It's like a low word. It doesn't mean it's just a narrow, it means low, miserable, inferior. Secular, the way of worldlings, ignoble and unbeneficial. That's the pursuit of happiness through the five senses. And number two, the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and mind, which is painful, ignoble and unbeneficial. The word is atta gilamata nu yoga. Anu yoga means like a practice, just the same as they yoke two balls together, or they yoke the ball to the cart to pull it. Now the yoga, like the yoga which people practice, like a yoke in English. And atta gilamata, kilama means to tire somebody, get very exhausted. So these are practices which basically exhaust your body and exhaust your mind. And remember that the Buddha gave this particular teaching first of all after he spent 6 years of just ascetic practices. He wasn't looking after his body at all. He was trying to conquer his body and got nowhere and got the great insight that maybe that was taking it too far. To find the middle way between exhausting your body and indulging your body. And when he started to eat properly and sleep properly and wash, that is when his first five disciples gave up on him. They said, he's given up the practice. He's not really a meditator anymore. Look at him. He's just indulging, going back to the worldly ways, but he had enough confidence to not believe his unenlightened disciples and give it a try. And of course he became fully enlightened, he became a Buddha. It's a very powerful little statement there. Just asceticism, torturing your body, sometimes creates more problems than it ever solves. You find that beautiful middle way, just in between. So you sleep not too much, not too little. Eat enough. Keep yourself fit and healthy. But not too little, not too much. When you meditate, use a chair if you need a chair. Use cushions. Look after your body. Don't indulge it, but look after it. And that means your body is fit and healthy. You've got energy. You're not tired, not exhausted. And that means that you've prepared your body for the path of liberation. So, the pursuit of happiness with the five senses? No. The pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and mind, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Without going to either of these extremes, the Buddha has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to wisdom, which leads to peace, to direct understanding, to enlightenment, to nirvana. All of those things need to be just paused. Gives rise to vision. your awareness gets stronger, so you can see, you can feel more. Gives rise to wisdom when you can experience more clearly, more powerfully. Again, you understand better. If you're, you know, if you're blind, if you're deaf, if you can't really feel, you know, you're only half in this world, even a quarter, and a quarter alive, of course you can't experience and know very much. But when you start to really wake up, your meditation starts to get strong, you're not fatigued, you can see the leaves on the tree, you can see the sunset, you can feel the texture of the carpet under your feet, you're more alive. And of course, the more alive you are, the more mindful you are, the more you get to know about this world. And the more you get to know about this world, the more wisdom you have, the more peace you have in this world. The wisdom leads to peace. You don't make so many mistakes. It's a direct understanding, not just believing a monk like me, or reading the books. You know how hard it is. Who should you believe? Which particular meditation technique should you follow? Which description should you accept as authoritative? You can never accept other people's experiences as authoritative. I always notice that what I say, you know, what I hear coming out of my lips, somehow or other, as it goes across to you and goes into your ears, it gets messed around a bit. And so sometimes what I say and what people say I said are two different things, because this is the way of our brain. So your direct experience is your own understanding of the Dhamma. It gives rise to direct understanding, and of course that gives rise to enlightenment and to Nibbana. And so what is this middle way? This middle way is nothing more than the Noble Eightfold Path. And again, retranslating it, because sometimes you ask people, what is the Eightfold Path? And they say the same old thing. They don't really understand what they're talking about. Right view, that's great. Right motivation, not right thought. Even when I was a young Buddhist, I was a meditator, and thinking was a problem. I couldn't find a right thought. It was almost like no thought was right. So that's one of the reasons why I thought, it didn't make any sense to me. But right motivation, when you check what the second factor of the Eightfold Path is, really understand what it means, then it's a motivation why you're doing what you're doing. Now, sometimes people say right intention, okay, maybe that's much better than right thought, but it's where you're coming from. And I've mentioned this so many times, you should all know the three right motivations: renunciation, letting go, kindness, and gentleness. And to me, I don't know about you, but when I first heard this or saw it, I thought, that is where the kindness comes up. Because everything else I've read in Buddhism, you do metta meditation, but it wasn't essential. There's an alternative. But here, when you see the second factor of the Eightfold Path, it's right there in the middle. That is where the kindness comes in. Where you're coming from, you're doing it out of kindness, out of gentleness, out of letting go. And sometimes saying letting go, renunciation, sometimes I've used another translation, it's not 100%, but it's 90%. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And sometimes people have got t-shirts, especially in places like Indonesia, they got that on the back of their t-shirts: make peace, be kind, be gentle, saying of Ajahn Brahm. And that just makes me feel uncomfortable, because I never said that, that's a Buddha. But anyway, that's close enough. I shouldn't have said that, should I? Close enough. I say it's, good enough. So, that's right. Right motivation, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Can't get past those. Right endeavor. These days, one of these days I'll change this. I'm getting towards right renunciation instead of right endeavor. What type of endeavor? It's like a letting go. We're disappearing. We're letting go of all our acquisitions, trying to have less, trying to renounce, saying no to things. So it's the right renunciation. And from there, right mindfulness, and lastly, of course, right stillness, never right concentration. And actually, if you look at that whole Eightfold Path, right view, you get some understanding of what's going on. When you have an understanding of what's going on in your right view, obviously from that, you know, you don't want to accumulate more experiences and accumulate more achievements. Ajahn Chah always used to say, we meditate to let go, not to gain more things. Live more simply, physically and emotionally, mentally. So it is a, from right view, we understand we're supposed to let go of things, renounce things, live more simply, just have more things, have less things in our life, more freedom, more space, more emptiness, less stuff. That's our motivation. This is why we're doing this. We're doing this for kindness and for gentleness. And of course, once those factors are really strong, it leads to right speech, kindness, let go. Somebody says something wrong to you, they call you stupid idiot. Oh, just let it go. You renounce it. You're not here to keep your reputation going. You're not here to sort of be a big shot. You're here just to disappear. So that means that the right motivation leads to the right type of speech, action, and livelihood. And then from there, again, the right renunciation, just letting go even more, to the point that when you sit down here, you do absolutely nothing. People actually just still crack jokes about that, Ajahn Brahm. Because I think it was Ajahn Sujato, he put in that how to change a light bulb. You know all those jokes they have online and how many people it takes to change a light bulb? And there's how many Ajahn Brahms that change a light bulb? And the answer is none. The light bulb will change itself. So anyway, I can see where he's coming from, having some humour. But this is actually what happens when you get out of the way, and the light bulb is just fine. So that's the, and then from there, the mindfulness becomes very strong. Now the whole idea of being awake, being alert, being able to hear, being able to see. When you let go of all these things, what you want, you're not seeing what you want to see. You're not just not hearing what you don't want to hear. When all of those wantings, acquisitions, sense of self start to vanish, you actually can see without any hindrance. You are seeing what's really there. Your mindfulness is becoming reliable. And as your mindfulness becomes reliable, as it starts to grow, where does it grow to? It leads into the jhanas. Powerful states of mind, created by stillness. You really are alert. Just like you've woken up. And what is waking up? That word in Pali is bujjati. Past participle Buddha. The awakened one. So what you're doing is, your mind is getting so strong because of stillness. And it gets powerful. There's the Eightfold Path for you. This is the middle way, awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise, obviously, to vision, to wisdom, to peace, direct understanding, to enlightenment, to nirvana. The pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, secular, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. It's obvious. When you look for pleasure in this life, do you ever get it? Sometimes, but then you lose it. You know what? It's anicca, impermanent. It doesn't last. Frustration, so you try even harder, still get frustrated. If you get what you want, you always want more. Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five states. So disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, secular, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fear. It is the right way. It is peaceful. And now, one of my favorite quotes, Dhammapada 273-276. The Noble Eightfold Path is the best of all practices. There's a few other little sentences there which I've deleted, just because, deleted, I think, not deleted. But because this definitely refers to the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the only path for purifying insight. There is no other. Follow this path and you will confuse Mara. I put the word discombobulate simply because that's one of my favourite words. You put in there confuse, and that's an ordinary word, but discombobulate, that's got class or status, I don't know what you want. So I love that word discombobulate. I don't know where it actually comes from, but it's a nice word to say it, discombobulate. I feel discombobulated today. Anyway, okay, confused, Mara. Yes, exactly. So anyway, because sometimes people say that insight is the only path, or that Satipatthana is the only path, or that jhana is the only path, or that this is the only path. And the Buddha actually did say an only path, but he made sure that was only used for the Eightfold Path. That is the only path. Eso wa magra, this only path, nati anya, no other, dasanasa visuddhiya. Dasanasa is seeing, insight, and visuddhiya is for purification of insight. Listen, the end of dying has been reached. No more dying for you. I shall instruct you, I shall teach you the Dhamma, practicing as you are instructed by realizing for yourselves in this very life through direct understanding, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth into monastic life. Only monastic life? Do any lay people become enlightened? Yes, they do. But if you become enlightened, fully enlightened, there are consequences. You cannot go back to the world and to your job on a Monday morning. Sorry, cannot be done. You've got a choice of two things. One, join the monastery. Or number two, you will die in 7 days. Do you think that's true? A lot of that stuff, being a rebellious monk, you know I'm a rebellious monk. I thought, come on, that's just fear. But after a while you think, hey, hang on, this may be true. And of course now you know it is true. Because if you're fully enlightened, totally enlightened, then there's no reason to keep on existing. The will to be, to live, is gone. If you're a monk or a nun, then that will to be is replaced by loving kindness, metta, being of service to others. Not being of service to the world, but being of service to the Dhamma. And so you've got no choice, it's just an inclination, it just happens, it's automatic. You become a monk or a nun. It's not that we need more monks and nuns, as you all know, we've got a big waiting list of monks or nuns, but if we become enlightened, we'll find a place somewhere. Have to. Otherwise, 7 days, and you're gone. Fascinating, isn't it? What keeps you alive? Why are you? And if there's no force to keep this five components of existence going, if the fuel is cut off, you're going to get another fuel pretty quickly, or your car will stop. Interesting stuff, but that's how it is. Okay, it's now 4 o'clock. Is there any questions? Yes. So, okay. Sue first, or I'll show you first. Okay, do you want to pass the microphone?
I've been talking about the middle way. I can recall reading when the Buddha was asked if the Eightfold Path leads to annihilation. And he said, it isn't being and it isn't not being.
Exactly.
There's something in the middle, and that's the middle way. that right?
That's correct. That's in the Kacchanagata Sutta. And that is the second middle way which the Buddha said. Not a way of practice, but a middle way of understanding this process called sukha. Who you are. It's a process. It's not that you are. It's not that you're not. It literally is the third option between the two, of existence and non-existence. It's arising, being for a little while, and then passing away. And then another thing, arising, staying for a while, and passing away. And so it's not that there's nothing there at all. It's not that there is something which lasts for a long period of time. It's a process. A cause and effect, not a thing. And he gave that process a name. He called it dependent origination, the steps of dependent origination. And of course, with the dependent origination, it's also dependent cessation. When those causes, especially of delusion, avijja, is stopped, and the whole thing just unwinds. And you cease. There's nothing really there anyway. It's just like going back to the simile of a flame. Does a flame exist? Of course a flame exists. But it's just momentary. Look at it clearly. Come from causes. When any one of those causes finishes, so does the flame finish. So you are a flame. You are but, so, a candle in the wind. Elton John was right. that makes sense. Okay, thank you. There's a question over there somewhere. Oh yeah, Elton John. Another candle in the wind.
I don't know, would it be true to say that even though we that we will everything and we are the ones who actually go and do it, but it's already been programmed long ago by conditioning, would that be correct?
To say it's been programmed long ago by conditioning, like it's hard enough even for us to program these computers over here to get decent sound. So there is a programming going on there, but it's so complex to think that you program it or someone programs it. Causes and effects, you can look at those causes for a few moments ago, maybe earlier today. I know I mentioned it to you that I remember giving a talk, I think, in Bodhidharma Monastery once, and Ajahn Sujata, because his name came up earlier, it's in my head, he said, he actually gave the talk a title, Why Ajahn Brahm Tells Bad Jokes. It's nothing to do with me, it's just because the cause and effect. I've been programmed to tell bad jokes by my father, by my culture, by so many other things. So don't blame me when I tell bad jokes. Just like the one I told earlier. Do you want to hear the bad joke for today? About this... I hope I don't get into trouble for this one. This young lady in New York, she finished her degree at university, and her mother had promised her that she'd, you know, pay for like a gap year. She always wanted to go to Africa and to explore some of the indigenous cultures over there. So off she went, having finished her degree. And when she came back 1 year later, her mother was waiting for her at the airport. And she came, followed, you know, almost just a foot or two behind, with this big African guy, you know, dreadlocks, beads, only wearing a loincloth, nothing else on him. It was just all not tattoos, but you know, these coverings of beads, and had a little rattle and necklaces made of crocodile teeth or whatever. And her mother took one look at him, and his the wife said, "Mummy, I'd like to introduce my husband to you." His mother said, "Darling, I ask you to find and marry a rich doctor, not a witch doctor." I hope no one gets offended by that. But anyway, sometimes, why did she marry that person? Was it really her choice? It appears to be our choice, but sometimes there's so many other things interfere, and that's a whole different sort of area of Dhamma. It links in here, but it's scary when you realize just how little your will it belongs to you. I said that in one of the first books. When I was young, I was trying to be a rebel. I went to the first Isle of Wight festival, like a big rock festival, 1970, I think that was. And I had my green velvet trousers. I was going to be rebellious. Guys don't wear bright green velvet trousers. I wasn't homosexual. I had girlfriends, but not at the same time, just one at a time. But anyway, I thought I was being rebellious, green velvet trousers. And when I went to the Isle of Wight Rock Festival, I saw so many other young men with green velvet trousers. And I realised it was just another uniform. Did I really choose to wear those? Or was it just conditioned into me? I thought I was being unique, showing my own individual nature. But then, how come so many other people showing their own individual nature also had green velvet trousers? So anyway, what do you choose? What don't you choose? Why? Scary. And if you're not scared, you haven't understood what I've been saying. Go to new places of understanding. And of course, that's why advertising works. That's why prime ministers get on the TV as much as they possibly can, you know, to try and change your will, to control you. Any other questions? Oh yeah. When a flame gets put out, where does the flame go? No, because even the cosmic soup disappears. Yeah, it's gone. It's supposed to be hard to comprehend. But after a while you get your head around that and just, why not? Where does this universe come from? Universe, Big Bang, but before the Big Bang, nothing there. So sometimes you wonder, how can this actually be? Because there's one basic law of science which everybody understands. You cannot create or destroy mass energy. It just transforms, sometimes mass to energy, nuclear bomb, please excuse me. But what happens if the total sum of mass energy in this universe balance? Sum total zero. If you could bring every part of the universe, bring it all together into one lump, would it explode because it's so hot? Or would they totally cancel each other out? Every atom, every fundamental particle, would that suddenly just go and disappear? And the answer is yes, it does. And I remember posing that to Professor Blair when he was the head of science at the UWA. And he looked at me and said, wow, Ajahn Brahm, you're so up to date. Omega equals one. It's true. If all the universe, you, your partner, your mother, everybody, if it all came together, all the galaxies, all the dark matter, the dark energy, if everything came together, one, it would just disappear. It would completely balance. And that'll be the end of the universe. We come from nothing. We go back to nothing. We are nothing. Okay? That doesn't matter. We'll be okay when we all go to nothing. I kind of like these ideas. Remember, I was a physicist before, theoretical physicist. I love these sorts of ideas. Always say it was Rutherford, the Kiwi, great man, who split the atom. And it was the Buddha, split the Atma. Those words are so close together. Why? Atom is a Greek word meaning indivisible, unsplittable. He did that. Those words are connected. Indo-European languages. Who you are, what the atom is. It's not a thing, it's a process. Coming and going. Dancing through time. And soon we come to the end of the dance. The ball is over and everybody vanishes. Which is a wonderful way of finishing this afternoon's talk, because I've got to rush back to Bodhidharma Monastery. It's a party of open day today. It's a full moon night tonight. So those of you who are lucky enough to be able to be in darker places, you can look up into the sky and you'll see the full moon. And if you're lucky, you'll see the rabbit in the full moon. Remember I told that story some time ago? See if you can see the rabbit in the full moon tonight. Okay, is there some questions from overseas? Oh my goodness. Can't get away that easy. Okay. From Scotland, from nowhere, from nowhere. Can you explain what a sankhara is? A sankhara is mostly means will. This is actually how the Buddha stated it. You know, it's the three sankharas, the will connected to the body, connected to the speech, connected to the mind. Will. And the things which have been willed. This is the active part of it, creating, and what happens afterwards. When an enlightened being dies, the stream of consciousness ends. Is there anything left? No, that's why it's called without remainder. Nothing left. Gone. Poof. At last, disappeared. I know that sometimes people like something left. It's like the old Disney fantasy. But eventually when you're enlightened, you can ride into the sunset, happy ever after. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen. And lastly, what is Passa? Passa is part of this process of what we take to be us. It is like the contact, it's the senses turning on. It's part of the turning on of any of the six senses. Sometimes you call it touch, sometimes you call it contact, sometimes... But it's just the Buddha analysing the way that experience works. For example, people always say hearing. You've got an intact sense of hearing, and there's a sound, and you pay... Sometimes they connect together, and you get sound consciousness, and you... The mind turns to that because there's nothing else which is taking its attention, and then you hear. That's the whole thing with the sense bases, the objects of the senses, the sense consciousness, the contact, and the experience. That's how it works. Not a bad description. Okay, so thank you from overseas, and thank you again. Sorry for rushing off, but... I do have, as people are supposed to be seeing me at 5:30 down in Serpentine as well before I go to the Patimokkha ceremony, so a bit of a rush. And tomorrow morning I'm going off 5 a.m. to the airport to go to Sydney for the Australian Sangha Association meeting. Oh, poor Ajahn. Okay, well, never. Well, actually, I'm not going anywhere. I just sit on the plane. The plane moves. I just sit there. I'm always here. Okay, so we can now just do this. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now we can now do the three bows to the virtue, peace, and compassion.
virtue, peace, and compassion.
Arahan Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddha Bhagavan San Abhivani.